From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. New Hanover County shows significant demographic and achievement disparities across its 42 schools. That's according to analysis from the Inclusion Project, a report out of the University of North Carolina's Center for Civil Rights in Chapel Hill. Between 2006 and 2010, New Hanover County's school board adopted a neighborhood school model that, according to that report, has exacerbated the disparities. Today, 66% of the schools in this county are racially imbalanced. The district's four magnet schools are now racially isolated, high-poverty schools. The most drastic change in demographics has taken place at Gregory Elementary, where white students now make up about 5% of the student population. Today, we're going to meet a man who has spent his professional life fighting for racial equality, particularly in the field of school desegregation. Theodore Shaw is the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the director of the University of North Carolina's Center for Civil Rights at UNC Law School in Chapel Hill. Professor Shaw, so pleased to welcome you to Coastline today.
Good to be with you, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about racial disparities in public schools, give us a call on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Professor Shaw, before you came to the UNC Center for Civil Rights, you had spent some years working on school desegregation for both the Justice Department and the NAACP. Tell us about some of that work and why this has become such a key part of your professional life.
Well, thank you. Let me, if I may, first clarify something that most people don't know and not familiar with, and that is that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, that's whom I work for, is not and has not been for many years, for decades, since 1957, part of the NAACP, although the NAACP is the parent organization. So the Legal Defense Fund is the organization that was headed by Thurgood Marshall, and that's the organization for which I worked. The NAACP is a membership organization, Legal Defense Fund, civil rights law firm. So I work for both the Justice Department and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, mostly for the Legal Defense Fund, but I started off at Justice straight out of law school, and there I did school desegregation cases in various parts of the South, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, other places. And it was an important time and an important experience. That was the era in which many of the school desegregation plans that went into effect were still being implemented. With, in some instances, a lot of opposition, but it was an era in which schools were being desegregated. When I went to the Legal Defense Fund, a lot of the work that we did was defensive work trying to stop resegregation of public schools.
So you worked on preventing the resegregation of public schools. Did you also work on forcing the implementation of some of these plans that in some cases took forever to actually implement, and some perhaps haven't even been entirely implemented?
Yes, although I somewhat bristle, not at you, but the term forced is a term that was very common when it came to desegregation, used usually in the context of a description of what was called busing. Forced busing, and people just resisted the notion that a court would and could order effectively desegregation. But the answer to the question ultimately is yes, in spite of my reaction.
Which is certainly valid here. We're going to talk about terms in a moment, too, the difference between integration and desegregation. But first, explain to us, most of our listeners are probably familiar with the most general aspect of
school desegregation and the history and how that came into being. But why is that important? That may sound like that's got an obvious answer, but I don't think it does in the face of what we see today. How do segregated schools affect children?
Well, I actually suspect in many instances that many people are not all that familiar with the history that is the predicate for desegregation efforts. I mean, somewhere in our minds, most of us know that at one time the states, at least in the South, and sometimes in other parts of the country, mandated segregation in public schools. Most people are not familiar with how our country, how our communities, how our schools came to look the way they did. And we think about the segregation that is ubiquitous as something that is just the result of happenstance, of choice. It is coincidental. And that simply isn't true. So this is an important conversation and discussion that we need to remind people of. Most segregation that exists in our country did not happen accidentally. It's the result of decades and decades of actions on the state, local, and federal level that segregated our schools, our communities, our housing, and many other ways of life. You know, my father, my grandmother, and my grandfather and other people lie not far from where we are right now in the old colored cemetery. We segregated our cemeteries. You know, people didn't want to lay for eternity next to black folks. White folks didn't. And so this is our experience. This is our history. And most people are not as familiar with it, and many don't want to think about it.
How do segregated schools impact children?
Well, Brown versus Board of Education, which, of course, was a Supreme Court case in 1954 that said separate but equal was unconstitutional in the field of public education, it has this passage in it that said to separate Negro children, the terminology of the time, from others of similar age and qualifications creates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. That was Brown versus Board of Education. There was a test done that was part of the evidence, the Dahl test, which had black children look at white dolls, black dolls otherwise identical, and they were asked which is a good doll, which is the bad doll, which is a smart doll, which is the doll that isn't smart, which is the pretty doll, which is a doll that's not pretty. And you know what the result of the test was.
And that those results have been replicated decades
they
later.
They have. And so the short answer to the question is this notion in Brown of inferiority that gets inculcated into black children. And that's still true today in many instances. And so the effect is to create life opportunities that are not equal. It is it's a stilted set of life opportunities as compared to the opportunities of other children. But also, we live in a very diverse society, and so the question is, how do we learn to interact with one another when we go to segregated schools? So the effects are profound.
How do you battle things like school segregation beyond the litigious aspect? Is there any way to go after the cause?
I do, but I do also want to add that the impact isn't only on black children. Their impact on white children, on Latino children, on Asian American, on all children. But I also believe that it is important to address these issues and try to battle these impacts in ways that go beyond the courtroom. Because ultimately, what courts can do is create a moment of opportunity in which we can change or take another course. But if we collectively don't take advantage of those opportunities, and if we don't inculcate the values of a desegregated or an even integrated community, then the courts are limited ultimately in what they can accomplish, although they are important.
What would you say to white parents who are listening now, whose children perhaps go to a majority white school that is a high-performing school in New Hanover County? Well, why does it matter to them whether schools become more integrated here?
Well, I would say a few things. I know that many white parents, not all of them, but many of them, too many of them, fear the experience that their children will have in schools where there are significant numbers of black children. And many of them also equate quality education with education in schools that are virtually all white or all white. And I think those are damaging messages. But I also think that their children are being damaged, although many parents may not want to believe that, because they are not being prepared to live and work in a world and in a country that is increasingly becoming more and more diverse. So the whole dynamic that we're engaged in now in this country, the fear that's manifested in our politics right now as the country becomes more brown, or in the aftermath of the first African-American or black president.
And I'll let you finish that point when we come back. I think Pew Research put out some numbers recently that support exactly that. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation about racial disparity in the school system. If you'd like to ask a question of Professor Theodore Shaw of the UNC Center for Civil Rights or weigh in, call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email your question today to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with Professor Theodore Shaw, the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the Director of the University of North Carolina's Center for Civil Rights at UNC Law School in Chapel Hill. It's an exploration today of school resegregation, and the phone lines are open on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Professor Shaw, just before we went to break, you were talking about why school segregation damages white children. It's not just contributing to a feeling of inferiority for an African-American child that could persist his or her whole life, but it also doesn't prepare white children for the world that is becoming. And I think 2016 numbers from the U.S. Census that Pew Research recently analyzed showed that for the first time, the population under 12 is majority people of color.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the rest of the thought with respect to the feelings of inferiority that Brown versus Board of Education talked about, obviously, is that many white children are inculcated with a false feeling of superiority, rather. And that's damaging also. But the inability of public schools to prepare students to live in a world that is diverse, that's a real problem in our society. And we're seeing some of that manifested in the discourse that is being driven today. I don't want to get too much into it because that could take us into places that we probably don't want to go right now.
Not prepared to go there today, but yes.
Right.
But it all does feed into, you were talking about the fear of parents. And that is sort of the micro example, one parent's fear of what would happen to their child white child, say, in a majority African-American school.
Well, that's right. And we also are finding ourselves, Pew has also studied this, not only increasingly segregated again by race, but also by economic status and class. I've been saying for a number of years now that I think that the great issue of the 21st century is going to be the issue of economic inequality. And I think it's going to present an existential threat to our society. I don't know how the form that's going to take, but we've got to do something. And these two things are interconnected, race and class or economic status. And public schools are the great, or should be the great equalizer. Public schools should be the place where we are taught about civil society, and we're taught about the values of civil society. And I still believe in that very, very strongly and very deeply.
You, in the past, have asked about whether our society, our culture, has the will to continue to support those values. And you ask, at what peril if we stop supporting those values? So I'm going to ask you, at what peril? What do we lose if we stop supporting those values?
Well, I think if we don't support the values of an inclusive society, then we become very divided. We are at odds with one another, in some ways at war with one another. And we've been there before. It's not like we don't know where this leads. You know, some years ago, I gave a lift to a young man from Wales from the Detroit airport into Ann Arbor. And as we started talking, he asked me about what I did, and I asked him about what he did, and I asked him what he thought about America. And he said, well, the thing that I'm most struck by, and I was unprepared for, is the way race still divides your country. And he said, and I'll never forget it, he said, it's like a civil war that you hold under your breath. And I thought that was a very striking description. And it was one that hit home. So I believe that if we are going to, in fact, be what we say we are as a country and as a society, that at least in part, much of this starts in the early years and not exclusively in public schools, but certainly public schools are the place where we teach values and civic values for our children and what it means to be a citizen of the United States.
In the first segment, you alluded to being part of, well, you may not have said you were part of President Obama's transition team.
Yes, I didn't mention it, but I was
okay.
For the Justice Department.
So. Right. I just silently thought that.
That's all right.
While you were talking about the fact that we've just had our first African-American president in this country. Now, that would seem to show some kind of progression and some of the loosening of this kind of intractability of this racial divide. Is that happening?
Well, you know, it's ironic that we live at this time in which so much has changed for the better. Although, and there are so many people who believe that it has not. And there are so many people who believe that the country's coming apart. In part, some of them believe because Barack Obama was president of the United States. But, you know, we're not where we were in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. We've seen, I never thought I'd live to see the day in my lifetime where we'd see an African-American president elected, and we did twice. I think that the aftermath of all of that is in part, not wholly, what's responsible for the discourse that we have right now and the nature of that discourse. So
this is a pendulum swing? It's a backlash?
I think it is. I think any honest or candid discussion acknowledges that it is. Look at the outbreak of racism right out front publicly, experienced by individuals, but also that's structurally evident these days. And I think it's hard to deny all that, even though a lot of people want to.
And what do you mean the structurally evident racism? What are you talking about there?
Well, I'm talking about the discrimination in the housing markets. And the studies have been done, if we do studies on housing discrimination, who gets to buy houses? Who gets to rent apartments? Where do they get to live? That's pretty evident these days. It's hard to deny. But also, even our topic for du jour, you know, school segregation, the resegregation of public schools in the name of neighborhood schools. But the resegregation of public schools is something that most people don't care about. And I'll add that not only it's not just white people who don't care about it. Many black people have given up on it in frustration. And they say, I don't really care about my child sitting next to white children. They shouldn't have to have that in order to learn. What I want is quality education. But the experience is that in this country, segregated schools that are virtually all black and brown don't end up with the kinds of resources that other schools end up with. Concentrated poverty is one of the most devastating phenomena in this country, and it is a phenomena that plagues public school systems throughout the country, including in part the New Hanover public schools.
We heard during the last school board election from candidates, both political parties, and the support or lack of support for neighborhood schools in this case, in this county, seemed to be exclusively split along partisan lines. In other words, the support for that model became a political position.
Yeah. Well,
how do we find our way out of that?
If I had the answer to that, unfortunately, I think the reality in our country has been for a long, long time that partisan politics align with issues of race. It used to be that the Republicans were the party where black folks were welcome. Right on up through and into the 1960s, and that flipped in 1964. It started to flip, perhaps, with the election of President Kennedy, but it was really in 64 when Goldberg was a Republican candidate, and certainly by 1970 when Nixon ran on a platform that explicitly exploited race. It by that time flipped, and black folks had gone over to the Democratic Party, which used to be the party of what they called Dixiecrats. But when Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, the story, apocryphal perhaps, but we don't know for sure, was that he turned to one of his aides and said, I've just handed the South to the Republicans for generations. And we see this alignment now of race and politics. Do I know the way out of it? No. Do I pray that we can find a way out of that alignment? Of course I do. But when we talk about redistricting, this is a tremendously partisan but also a racial set of endeavors.
You've fought for so many years along the lines of eliminating racial disparity and working for school segregation. Years later, now 2010, and you look at a county like New Hanover that offers numbers demonstrating this undeniable racial segregation. And when you think about the fact that this comes from white people Do you ever just get tempted to throw up your hands and say, you know what, I'm tired of chasing these people and seeing children of color rejected or treated as less than, and we're just going to go and do our own thing? I mean, does it ever just get exhausting where you think you're not worth it?
Well, look, and I'm conscious of how this sounds, so let me acknowledge this. I know a lot of white folks. I know a lot of good white folks. And the people who care about these issues, they don't always act on them. And I'm not interested in demonizing anyone. Do I get frustrated sometimes? Yes. Do I acknowledge the difference, the irony in black people who talk about in some ways separation, Nation of Islam, for example, Louis Farrakhan being condemned, and yet at the same time, many white people are fighting integration or desegregation. I see that, that irony. Yes, it's frustrating sometimes, but I think collectively, if we give up on the values of an America which welcomes all of us, if we give up on the values of equality, you know, if we allow ourselves to slip back into superiority and inferiority, if we allow public schools to educate black and brown children in a way that doesn't give them a chance in life, we are all collectively going to pay the price. I saw or heard a report on the news just yesterday about the need to have people who are qualified and capable to serve in the armed forces to defend the country, and the issue of whether or not people who were born in other countries who are immigrants should be allowed into the military to serve in these jobs. Well, I'm not addressing that point. I'm not opposed to that, although I think we have to be careful. But what this shows, what it demonstrates, is something that many of us have pointed out for a long time, which is that if we don't find a way to educate those of us who are American citizens, we will have to turn to other people. By the way, I think that we should welcome people from other countries as long as we're not taking in folks who are opposed to American values, if that makes sense. But that's a different discourse than the one that I think our president right now wants to have. But the point is that I think we have to educate the people of the United States. And if we don't do that, then we're certainly going to have these other problems in force.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of school segregation, its effects, the new trends, how and whether to fight the tide. Theodore Shaw is the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the Director of the University of North Carolina Center for Civil Rights at UNC Law School in Chapel Hill. And he's answering your questions on this live Thursday discussion. You can ask your own question by calling us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Allie from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi there. It's actually Sally, and I really appreciate this discussion today. My husband and I moved to North Carolina from another state. We're a white family, and both of us went to predominantly white schools. When we had our boys here in Wilmington, we really wanted to give them an educational opportunity that we did not have, and our boys both went through what were then the magnet schools, Gregory and Williston. And pretty typically, they were minorities in their own classrooms. They had an African-American principal. They had black teachers. They just had a fantastic educational experience in every way in these schools. And I also wanted to say that they then went on and got very good scholarships to top colleges. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that they could get along with lots of different kinds of people and that a more global society was normal. And I just wish more families in the Wilmington area would take advantage of this opportunity, and also that how important it is to continue to resource these schools and programs, because they offer our kids something that you just can't replace.
Sally, did you have any fear as a parent sending your kids into a population of students in which they were minorities?
I did not have any fear. I just felt the first time I visited the school, my husband and I felt at ease. We saw grandparents walking their children to the school. We knew that many of the teachers knew the parents and had gone to school. It just felt like a really welcoming community for us. And yes, you know, there were times where, yes, there are lockdowns and we'd get a call of this and that, but I felt so safe and had so much faith in the care and love of the faculty and staff at these schools. And I really felt that it was not a trade-off in any way.
Sally, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today. Professor Shaw, can we just briefly talk about terms? We're going to go to break in a minute, but what is the difference between integration and desegregation? And what are we working on right now?
That's a great question. And when we talk about integration, it's not a term that many people use anymore. It sounds too 60-ish. Desegregation, as I see it, is the undoing of the affirmative act of segregation. We can desegregate schools as we have in many instances. Integration, in my view, goes beyond desegregation.
And when we come back from this break, then I'll let you explain more about what integration actually is. A conversation about racial disparity in the public school system. If you'd like to ask a question of Theodore Shaw of the UNC Center for Civil Rights, call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Have our public schools resegregated? Here to explore that question with us and look more closely at the implications is Theodore Shaw, the Julius L. Chambers Distinguished Professor of Law and the director of the University of North Carolina Center for Civil Rights at UNC Law School in Chapel Hill. The phone lines are open on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment for you to get your question or comment in during the live Thursday broadcast. Professor Shaw, just before we went to break, you were explaining the difference between desegregation and integration. And you said that desegregation was just the undoing of the segregation that had happened, but integration was a whole universe beyond that. What does that mean?
I think of integration as the affirmative act of a shared existence, whether we're talking about in public schools or in our communities elsewhere, so that we all share our experiences. We're not only stopping the act of separating ourselves from one another, but we are affirmatively sharing our experiences, our existence, et cetera. And so I think that in some ways desegregation is a predicate for integration. Although these days I don't think there's a tremendous amount of public support for either of those things, sadly.
So if we go back then to the discussion about what happened here during the last election, the last school board election, and the people who insisted on supporting the neighborhood schools model because it's better for the kids. You don't want to bus kids all the way across the county. Not that New Hanover County is that large geographically, but you don't want your kid that far away from home because that means the kid has to get up that much earlier. The kid gets home that much later. If there is some sort of issue with the child during the school day, the parents or the grandparents are that much farther away and may not have transportation. And I've heard this argument from both white people and from African American people who actually I can't say that. I've heard white people say that African American people have said that. That's what I've heard. So what do you say to that? It's not good for the kid.
Well, I think we have to choose what's important to us. The reality is that most children who attend public schools in this country, and I think it would be true in New Hanover County, even if we weren't talking about school desegregation, they take buses. They take them for safety reasons. They take them because of the distances between schools and homes. So, yes, there's perhaps a longer ride sometimes, but I've seen white parents choose to put their children on buses and send them, as I always say, to West Hell if at the other end of that trip is a majority white school that they perceive to offer quality education. I'm not saying that that in an ideal world it wouldn't be nice to have children walk around the corner to school, but most children aren't going to have those experiences anyway. And so the question is, given the effects of segregation on our society, on all of us, given the impact of concentrated poverty and racial segregation, and given the experiences that children of all races have in segregated schools and what that teaches them and doesn't teach them about one another, the question is, do we value a desegregated and, yes, even integrated education? Look, I don't believe that there's anything special about white children that rubs off on black children and imbues them with a stronger ability to learn. That's not the issue. But I do believe that there are certain things that come with segregated and desegregated education in this country and in North Carolina and in New Hanover County. And the question is whether those are things that we care about or we don't care about. For many white parents, they may say, we don't care about desegregation, but I think we collectively will all pay a price if we don't give attention to these issues.
The Inclusion Project is this project that examines data. It examines demographic data across a number of areas where there are racial disparities, including schools, housing, where toxic waste dumps, landfills are located, and other kinds of demographics within North Carolina. What kind of a trend are you seeing across all of these metrics? And do they feed one another, or are they discrete data sets?
Well, it's an amazing thing when you take these data sets, as you describe them, whether we're talking about poverty, school segregation, whether we're talking about toxic waste dumps, housing segregation, how electoral districts are drawn. You know, we're talking about, we call it the Inclusion Project for a reason. But when you overlay these maps on top of one another, you get a very clear and powerful picture, a portrait, if you will, of how we live collectively, because concomitantly, of course, there are another set of maps that can be drawn in other communities with other demographics. But these things, they show the kind of disadvantages that that people live with and under, and it's not accidental. I think that we should be able to show these maps in my naive moments, and I think we should be able to say, look at this. Now what are we going to do about it? But of course, it isn't that easy.
Can you give us an example of one of those set of circumstances or scenarios that you say is not accidental? Do you mean, say, locating a landfill next to a community that's largely made up of people of color?
Oh, sure. And it may happen it does happen for a number of reasons. You know, who's politically empowered? You know, who can defeat the placement of a landfill or a toxic waste facility in their communities? Who has the power to do that?
Well, that shouldn't happen in this country because there's environmental justice is part of the EPA's enforcement, isn't it? So if a minority community was being, say, negatively impacted by an environmental issue like that, it would fall under that rubric of environmental justice, and then it would be taken care of.
Would that it was so easy. In fact, we have pushed the EPA on these issues. We have filed complaints about these issues. The EPA, even under other administrations, hasn't been aggressive in ensuring that vulnerable communities are not saddled with these kinds of inequities. Of course, the EPA under the current administration is in danger of having a lot of its power taken away. So it happens all the time. That's the rule, not the exception. And we find it in communities of color disproportionately.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of school segregation. We have Theodore Shaw with us today. He is the director of the University of North Carolina Center for Civil Rights at UNC Law School in Chapel Hill. And he's answering your questions on this live Thursday discussion. You can ask your question by calling us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Cordelia from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm just calling because I'm an expectant mother who just moved to Wilmington. I've lived all over the country. I've seen the tremendous benefits of an integrated, peaceful society. And my question is, I didn't realize until I moved here how functionally segregated Wilmington is. And as an expectant mother, I want my child to have a well-rounded, you know, experience and be friends with and know people from a variety of different backgrounds. And I'm wondering, in such a functionally segregated society as ours is locally, do you have any advice or recommendations for how to achieve that? The only place I've seen that's really integrated here is the YMCA.
That's a great question, Cordelia. Thank you so much. Professor Shaw, any ideas?
I didn't catch the last word, the one place where she saw this.
The YMCA.
Oh, the YMCA.
Yes.
Okay. So I guess I would start by saying what I've been saying, which is that in our society, neither segregation nor desegregation has happened accidentally. I think we have to decide and choose what our values are, what's important to us. The YMCA certainly has values that it adopted because it's important to the credo of the YMCA. And I think in some ways in our schools or in our communities, we have to decide what's important to us. And so I appreciate everything that you've just said. And the only thing I can say is that I think it's important for parents who believe what you believe to be at the school board meetings and, in fact, to run for the school board. It shouldn't just be those who believe that we ought to only be about caring for the children who look like us, that we don't have an investment in all of our children. And so I just encourage you and other parents to be active.
You know, you talk about an investment in our children, and if you put the butterflies and rainbows aside and get away from just let's all hold hands and sing kumbaya, and you get to the economic reality of this, isn't there something that makes this not even a high human rights value, but something that is inherently economically selfish about making sure that everyone gets a really high quality education? I mean, don't we pay for it,
yes,
in dollars if
absolutely
we don't do that?
Absolutely. And I'm a little concerned because I didn't articulate something very well before. I don't want anybody to think that I'm not welcome. I'm not one who welcomes people from other countries into the United States. I think that's the great American story. But what I was trying to articulate before was exactly what you're talking about. There are some ways in which the failure to educate well black and brown children and poor children will come back and bite us in many respects. It's not just about, as you say, butterflies and doing, you know, and joining hands and singing kumbaya. I actually think that kumbaya gets a short shrift and a bad name. You know, it's a wonderful concept and
yes,
idea and
yes,
song, and it's beautiful, and I believe in it, but not in the way a lot of the cynics believe in it and use it. But the point is this. If we don't find a way to provide opportunity for all of our people in this country, one way or another, we're going to have to deal with our failure to do so. That is self-interest. And self-interest is a lot more reliable and dependable than doing things out of altruism. Altruism is fine, but I think that self-interest is much more powerful and reliable.
And we have Dave from Brunswick County. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. I had an observation that I want to share, and maybe it's difficult to go back this far, but I was born and raised in Baltimore, and it initially is an elementary school. It was in a local community school, which is probably 99% white, and it's a small neighborhood type area, but lots of kids. And then I transitioned to a middle school, which really wasn't that far away. We had to walk to it, but it was in a different neighborhood area. And it was probably 75 to 80% black. And it was a real shocker not to go from one environment to another environment as a kid. But at the same time, when I was in elementary school, I knew black families, and they were very traditional in terms of parents and children and respect and things like that. And after making the move to the middle school as a young child...
And Dave, I'm going to have to speed you up a little bit here. So go ahead.
And making that transition to the middle school and then later on to a citywide public school, I really appreciate what children go through when they don't have a diverse background or early on and have to go through adjustments that are sometimes very scary, but really not often necessary if they had started out in a more diverse setting, at least at the public school level. So that's my comment.
Thank you so much, Dave. Appreciate your call. And that's this edition of Coastline. Professor Theodore Shaw, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Caleb Covington engineered today's show. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or go old school and tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.